Vice President-elect Brooke Armstrong had six main tasks in the 10 weeks between election and inauguration. Sixth, and least important, was the continuation of his duties as junior senator from North Dakota until his term officially ended. There were nearly 650,000 people in the state, and any one of them might want attention at any time. But Armstrong assumed they all understood they were in limbo until his successor took over. Equally, Congress wasn't doing much of anything until January, so his senatorial duties didn't occupy much of his attention. Fifth task was to ease his successor into place back home. He had scheduled two rallies in the state so he could hand the new guy on to his own tame media contacts. It had to be a visual thing, shoulder to shoulder, plenty of grip and grin for the cameras, Armstrong taking a metaphoric step backward, the new guy taking a metaphoric step forward. The first rally was planned for the 20th of November, the other 4 days later. Both would be irksome, but party loyalty demanded it. Fourth task was to learn some things. He would be a member of the National Security Council, for instance. He would be exposed to stuff a junior senator from North Dakota couldn't be expected to know. A CIA staffer had been assigned as his personal tutor, and there were Pentagon people coming in and Foreign Service people. It was all kept as fluid as possible, but there was a lot of work to be fitted around everything else. And everything else was increasingly urgent. The third task was where it started to get important. There were some tens of thousands of contributors who had supported the campaign nationally. The really big donors would be taken care of in other ways, but the individual $1,000 and up supporters needed to share the success too. So the party had scheduled a number of big receptions in D.C. where they could all mill around and feel important and at the center of things. Their local committees would invite them to fly in and dress up and rub shoulders. They would be told it wasn't officially certain yet whether it would be the new president or the new vice president hosting them. In practice, three-quarters of the duty was already scheduled to fall to Armstrong. The second task was where it started to get really important. Second task was to stroke Wall Street. A change of administration was a sensitive thing, financially. No real reason why there should be anything but smooth continuity. But temporary nerves and jitters could snowball fast, and market instability could cripple a new presidency from the get-go. So a lot of effort went into investor reassurance. The president-elect handled most of it himself, with the crucial players getting extensive personal FaceTime in D.C., but Armstrong was slated to handle the 2nd Division people up in New York. There were five separate trips planned during the 10-week period. But Armstrong's first and most important task of all was to run the transition team. A new administration needs a roster of nearly 8,000 people, and about 800 of them need confirmation by the Senate, of which about 80 are really key players. Armstrong's job was to participate in their selection and then use his Senate connections to grease their way through the upcoming confirmation process. The transition operation was based in the official space on G Street, but it made sense for Armstrong to lead it from his old Senate office. All in all, it wasn't fun. It was grunt work, but that's the difference between being first and second on the ticket. So the 3rd week after the election went like this. Armstrong spent Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday inside the Beltway working with the transition team. His wife was taking a well-earned post-election break at home in North Dakota, so he was temporarily living alone in his Georgetown row house. Froelich packed his protection detail with her best agents and kept them all on high alert. He had 4 agents camping out with him in the house and 4 metro cops permanently stationed outside in cars, 2 in front and 2 in the alley behind. A Secret Service limo picked him up every morning and drove him to the Senate offices, with the 2nd car following. The gun car, it was called. There was the usual efficient transfer across the sidewalks at both ends. Then 3 agents stayed with him throughout the day. His personal detail. 3 tall men. Dark suits, white shirts, quiet ties, sunglasses even in November. They kept him inside a tight, unobtrusive triangle of protection. Always unsmiling. Eyes always roving. Physical placement always subtly adjusting. Sometimes he could hear faint sounds from their radio earpieces. They wore microphones on their wrists and carried automatic weapons under their jackets. He thought the whole experience was impressive, but he knew he was in no real danger inside the office building. There were D.C. cops outside. the Hills owned security inside, permanent metal detectors on all the street doors, and all the people he saw were either elected members or their staffers, who had been security cleared many times over. But Froelich wasn't as sanguine as Armstrong was. She watched for Reacher in Georgetown and on the Hill, and saw no sign of him. He wasn't there. Neither was anybody else worth worrying about. It should have relaxed her, but it didn't. The first scheduled reception for mid-level donors was held on Thursday evening in the ballroom of a big chain hotel. The whole building was swept by dogs during the afternoon, and key interior positions were occupied by Metro cops who would stay put until Armstrong finally left many hours later. Froelich put two Secret Service agents on the door, six in the lobby, and eight in the ballroom itself. Another four secured the loading dock, which is where Armstrong would enter. Discreet video cameras covered the whole of the lobby and the whole of the ballroom, and each was connected to its own recorder. The recorders were all slaved to a master timecode generator, so there would be a permanent, real-time record of the whole event. The guest list was 1,000 people long. November weather meant they couldn't line up on the sidewalk, and the tenor of the event meant security had to be pleasantly unobtrusive. So the standard winter protocol applied, which was to get the guests in off the street and into the lobby immediately through a temporary metal detector placed inside the frame of the entrance door. Then they milled around inside the lobby and eventually made their way to the ballroom door. Once there, their printed invitations were checked and they were asked for photo ID. The invitations were laid face down on a glass sheet for a moment and then handed back as souvenirs. Under the glass sheet was a video camera working to the same time code as the others, so names and faces were permanently tied together in the visual record. Finally, they passed through a second metal detector and onward into the ballroom. Froelich's crew were serious but good-humored and made it seem more like they were protecting the guests themselves from some thrilling, unspecified danger rather than protecting Armstrong from them. Froelich spent her time staring at the video monitors, looking for faces that didn't fit. She saw none, but she kept on worrying anyway. She saw no sign of Reacher. She wasn't sure whether to be relieved or annoyed about that. Was he doing it or not? She thought about cheating and issuing his description to her team. Then she thought better of it. Win or lose, I need to know, she thought. Armstrong's two-car convoy entered the loading dock a half hour later, by which time the guests had drunk a couple of glasses of cheap sparkling wine and eaten as many soggy canapés as they wanted. His personal three-man detail brought him in through a rear passageway and kept to a 10-foot radius for the duration. His appearance was timed to last 2 hours, which gave him an average of a little over 7 seconds per guest. On a rope line, 7 seconds would be an eternity. But this situation was different, primarily in the handshaking method. A campaigning politician learns very quickly to fumble the handshake and grip the back of the recipient's hand, not the palm. It creates a breathless, "so much support here, I've got to be quick" type of drama. And better still, it means it's strictly the Paul's choice when he lets go, not the supporter's. But in an event of this nature, Armstrong couldn't use that tactic, so he had to shake properly and work fast to keep to 7 seconds each. Some guests were content with brevity, and others hung on a little longer, gushing their congratulations like maybe he hadn't experienced any before. There were some men who went for the two-handed forearm grip. Some put their arms around his shoulders for private photographs. Some were disappointed that his wife wasn't there, some weren't. There was one woman in particular who took his hand in a firm grip and held on for 10 or 12 seconds, even pulling him nice and close and whispering something in his ear. She was surprisingly strong and nearly pulled him off balance. He didn't really hear what she whispered, maybe her room number. But she was slim and pretty, with dark hair and a great smile, so he wasn't too upset about it. He just smiled back gratefully and moved on. His Secret Service detail didn't bat an eye. He worked a complete circle around the room, eating nothing, drinking nothing, and made it back out of the rear door after 2 hours and 11 minutes. His personal detail put him back in his car and drove him home. The sidewalk crossing was completely uneventful, and another 8 minutes later his house was locked down for the night and secure. Back at the hotel, the rest of the security detail withdrew unnoticed, and the 1,000 guests left over the next hour or so. Froelich drove straight back to her office and called Stuyvesant at home just before midnight. He answered right away and sounded like he had been holding his breath and waiting for the phone to ring.
"Secure," she said.
"Okay. Any problems?"
"None that I saw."
"You should review the video anyway. Look for faces."
"I plan to."
"Happy about tomorrow?"
"I'm not happy about anything."
"Your outsider working yet?"
"Waste of time. 3 full days and he's nowhere to be seen."
"What did I tell you? It wasn't necessary."
There was nothing to accomplish in D.C. on Friday morning, so Armstrong stayed home and had his CIA guy come in for 2 hours teaching. Then his detail rehearsed the full motorcade exfiltration. They used an armored Cadillac with 2 escort Suburbans, flanked by 2 cop cars and a motorcycle escort. They drove him to Andrews Air Force Base for a midday flight to New York City. As a courtesy, the defeated incumbents had allowed him the use of Air Force 2, although technically it couldn't use that call sign until it had a real, inaugurated vice president in it, so for the moment it was just a comfortable private airplane. It flew into LaGuardia, and 3 cars from the Secret Service's New York field office picked the party up and drove them south to Wall Street, with an NYPD motorcycle escort riding ahead of them. Froelich was already in position inside the stock exchange. The New York field office had plenty of experience working with the NYPD, and she was comfortable that the building was adequately secure. Armstrong's reassurance meetings were held in a back office and lasted 2 hours, so she relaxed until the photo call. The transition team's media handlers wanted news pictures on the sidewalk in front of the building's pillars, sometime after the closing bell. She had no chance whatever of persuading them otherwise, because they desperately needed the positive exposure. But she was profoundly unhappy about her guy standing still in the open air for any period of time. She had agents video the photographers for the record and check their press credentials twice and search every camera bag and every pocket of every vest. She checked in by radio with the local NYPD lieutenant and confirmed that the perimeter was definitively secured to 1,000 feet on the ground and 500 vertically. Then she allowed Armstrong out with the assorted brokers and bankers, and they posed for 5 whole agonizing minutes. The photographers crouched on the sidewalk right at Armstrong's feet so they could get group head and shoulder shots with the New York Stock Exchange lintel inscription floating overhead.
"Too much proximity," Froelich thought.
Armstrong and the financial guys stared optimistically and resolutely into the middle distance, endlessly. Then, mercifully, it was over. Armstrong gave his patented, "I'd love to stay," wave, and backed away into the building. The financiers followed him, and the photographers dispersed. Froelich relaxed again. Next up was a routine road trip back to Air Force 2, and a flight to North Dakota for the first of Armstrong's handover rallies the next day, which meant she had maybe 14 hours without major pressure. Her cell phone rang in the car as they got close to LaGuardia. It was her senior colleague from the Treasury side of the organization at his desk in D.C.
"That bank account we're tracking? The customer just called in again. He's wiring 20 grand to Western Union in Chicago."
"In cash?"
"No, cashier's check."
"A Western Union cashier's check? For 20 grand? He's paying somebody for something. Goods or services? Gotta be."
Her colleague made no reply, and she clicked her phone off and just held it in her hand for a second.
Chicago? Armstrong wasn't going anywhere near Chicago.
Air Force 2 landed in Bismarck, and Armstrong went home to join his wife and spend the night in his own bed in the family house in the lake country south of the city. It was a big old place, with an apartment above the garage block that the Secret Service took over as its own. Froelich withdrew Mrs. Armstrong's personal detail to give the couple some privacy. She gave all the personal agents the rest of the night off and tasked 4 more to stake out the house, 2 in front, 2 behind. State troopers made up the numbers, parked in cars on a 300-yard radius. She walked the whole area herself as a final check, and her cell phone rang as she came back into the driveway.
"Froelich?"
Reacher said.
"How did you get this number?"
"I was a military cop. I can get numbers."
"Where are you?"
"Don't forget those musicians, okay? In Atlantic City? Tonight's the night."
Then the phone went dead. She walked up to the apartment above the garage and idled some time away.
She called the Atlantic City office at 1 a.m. and was told that the old couple had been paid the right money at the right time and escorted to their car and all the way out to I-95, where they had turned north. She clicked off her phone and sat for a spell in a window seat, just thinking. It was a quiet night, very dark, very lonely, cold. Distant dogs barked occasionally. No moon, no stars. She hated nights like this. The family house situations were always the trickiest. Eventually, anybody got thoroughly sick of being guarded, and even though Armstrong was still amused by the novelty, she could tell he was ready for some downtime. And certainly his wife was. So she had nobody at all in the interior, and was relying exclusively on perimeter defense. She knew she should be doing more, but she had no real option. At least, not until they explained the extent of the present danger to Armstrong himself, which they hadn't yet done, because the Secret Service never does. Saturday dawned bright and cold in North Dakota, and preparations began immediately after breakfast. The rally was scheduled for 1 o'clock on the grounds of a church community center on the south side of the city. Froelich had been surprised that it was an outdoor event, but Armstrong had told her that it would be heavy overcoat weather, nothing more. He told her that North Dakotans usually didn't retreat indoors until well after Thanksgiving, at which point she was almost overcome by an irrational desire to cancel the whole event. But she knew the transition team would oppose her, and she didn't want to fight losing battles this early, so she said nothing. Then she almost proposed Armstrong wear a Kevlar vest under his heavy overcoat, but eventually she decided against it. "Poor guy's got 4 years of this, maybe 8," she thought. "He's not even inaugurated yet. Too early." Later, she wished she had gone with her first instinct. The church community center's grounds were about the size of a soccer field and were bordered to the north by the church itself, which was a handsome white clapboard structure, traditional in every way. The other three sides were well fenced, and two of them backed onto established housing subdivisions, with the third fronting onto the street. There was a wide gateway that opened into a small parking lot. Froelich banned parking for the day and put two agents and a local cop car on the gate, with 12 more cops on foot on the grass just inside the perimeter. She put two cop cars in each of the surrounding streets and had the church itself searched by the local police canine unit and then closed and locked. She doubled the personal detail to 6 agents because Armstrong's wife was accompanying him. She told the detail to stick close to the couple at all times. Armstrong didn't argue with that. Being seen in the center of a prowling pack of 6 tough guys looked very high level. His successor designate would be happy about it, too. Some of that D.C. power elite status might rub off on him. The Armstrongs made it a rule never to eat at public events. It was too easy to look like idiots, greasy fingers, trying to talk while chewing. So they had an early lunch at home and drove up in convoy and got right to the business at hand. It was easy enough, even relaxing in a way. Local politics was not Armstrong's problem anymore. Wouldn't be much of a problem for his successor either, to be truthful. He had a handsome, newly minted plurality and was basking in a lot of reflected glow. So the afternoon turned out to be not much more than a pleasant stroll around a pleasant piece of real estate. His wife was beautiful. His successor stayed at his side throughout. There were no awkward questions from the press. All 4 network affiliates and CNN were there. All the local papers had sent photographers, and stringers from the Washington Post and the New York Times showed up, too. All in all, it went so well, he began to wish they hadn't bothered to schedule the follow-up event. It really wasn't necessary. Froelich watched the faces. She watched the perimeters. She watched the crowd, straining to sense any alteration in the herd behavior that might indicate tension or uneasiness or sudden panic. She saw nothing. Saw no sign of Reacher, either. Armstrong stayed 30 minutes longer than anticipated, because the weak fall sun bathed the field in gold, and there was no breeze, and he was having a good time, and there was nothing scheduled for the evening except a quiet dinner with key members of the state legislature. So his wife was escorted home, and his personal detail herded him back toward the cars and drove him north into the city of Bismarck itself. There was a hotel adjacent to the restaurant, and Froelich had arranged rooms for the dead time before the meal. Armstrong napped for an hour and then showered and dressed. The meal was going well when his chief of staff fielded a call. The outgoing president and vice president
were formally summoning the president-elect and the vice-president-elect to a one-day transition conference at the Naval Support Facility in Thurmont, starting early the next morning. It was a conventional invitation, because inevitably there was business to discuss, and it was delivered in the traditional way, last minute and pompous, because the lame ducks wanted to push the world around one last time. But Froelich was delighted, because the unofficial name for the Naval Support Facility in Thurmont is Camp David, and there is no safer place in the world than that particular wooded clearing in the Maryland mountains. She decided they should all fly back to Andrews immediately and take Marine helicopters straight out to the compound. If they spent all night and all day there, she would be able to relax completely for 24 hours. But late on Sunday morning, a Navy steward found her at breakfast in the mess hall and plugged a telephone into a baseboard socket near her chair. Nobody uses cordless or cellular phones at Camp David, too vulnerable to electronic eavesdropping.
"Call transferred from your main office, ma'am," the steward said.
There was empty silence for a second, and then a voice.
"We should get together,"
Reacher said.
"Why?"
"Can't tell you on the phone."
"Where have you been?"
"Here and there."
"Where are you now?"
"In a room at the hotel you used for the reception Thursday."
"You got something urgent for me?"
"A conclusion."
"Already? It's only been 5 days. You said 10.
5 is enough."
Froelich cupped the phone.
"What's the conclusion?"
Then she found herself holding her breath.
"It's impossible,"
Reacher said.
She breathed out and smiled. "Told you so."
"No. Your job is impossible. You should get over here, right now."